All right. Let's just move on with it. More sex. And this time, lots of it. Jerry Chippier, polygamy, just on top of everything else that we have to chat about. What the heck is going on here in British Columbia? Why does everybody want Mother Government to bless their unions and all kinds of things and get government money and cause constitutional questions and fill our court spaces up with what is a really important subject matter, one that you're a part of? Welcome to the show, Jerry.
Well, thank you very much. It's great to be on with you.
We may not need to introduce Jerry Chippier to our audience, but just for those who are tuning in late or who are not familiar with the name, Jerry's a lawyer who has been willing to take on some cases that most people don't want to take on. And he's a very committed believer, a solid, very moral individual, and he's willing to stand up and stand in court for what he believes is right.
Well, so, not to mention he's a hell of a good lawyer, too.
Well, that helps.
Jerry, can you give a little bit of background? Because, you know, this issue of polygamy keeps kind of coming up, bubbling when some activities happen, then we don't hear anything about it, and then it bubbles up again and everybody, you know, remembers for a moment, then it goes away. But this case is very much alive and well before our courts. You were a part of this process. Can you give us a little bit of background on why British Columbia, and I understand the federal government, the Attorney General's office from the federal government is also involved in this case, as well as oodles of other interveners, Christian Legal Fellowship being one of which you are their chief lead counsel for in this matter. How did all this come about, and why is the Christian Legal Fellowship involved in this, and what is their position?
Well, to go back to the beginning, and I'll be brief, the British Columbia government had for some time taken the position of live and let live. And no action was taken, notwithstanding many complaints from individuals familiar with the polygamous communities in Bountiful. A new attorney general was appointed a few years ago, and he decided to look into the matter, and he came to the conclusion that crimes were being committed, violations of the criminal code, in fact, were occurring, and that women and children were being abused. He then appointed a special prosecutor. That prosecutor came to the conclusion that the law was unconstitutional and decided not to prosecute. The attorney general went ahead anyway, appointed another prosecutor, but unfortunately, because the criminal law is very technical, and it should be to protect individuals from being improperly prosecuted, unfortunately, a technical breach of the law occurred in that transition, and the courts set aside the prosecution. The attorney general was not deterred, and the government of British Columbia decided to address the very issue that the prosecutor had addressed in his decision not to go ahead with charges, and that is the constitutionality of the prohibition in the criminal code against polygamy and bigamy.
Okay.
And then the British Columbia government decided that they would refer the matter, as they are allowed under legislation, through an order of the Lieutenant Governor, and the Attorney General decided to do it at the trial court level so that the trial level would hear all of the evidence about polygamy and would be able to make a full decision on the question of whether polygamy can be banned under our criminal code in light of the Charter and the constitutional protections for civil liberties. The decision to move ahead was made. The referral was made. The Chief Justice decided to hear it himself. That's British Columbia's Chief Justice Bowman. The Attorney General then gave notice to the Government of Canada. The Government of Canada decided to join in and to support the British Columbia Attorney General. Both Attorneys General decided that this law was both proper, constitutional, and that it needed to be defended vigorously in the courts. The governments then gave notice to the public and said, if you are an interested party, you can intervene on one side or the other. And the government also decided to fund the other side, because you don't want to just have a court hear one side of an argument. And so in our system, both sides are funded to ensure that if a decision is made, it's made after full argument with evidence and a legal argument from both sides. And
that's true in the courts.
That's
not true in the
Human
Rights
Commission. That's where we ended up with a trial starting in November, and it went for 42 days, 10,000 pages of transcript, and then ultimately over 1,000 pages of legal argument. And I represented the Christian Legal Fellowship in that case, and it concluded in April. And Chief Justice Bowman is right now writing his decision, and we expect that decision sometime before the end of the year.
Now, some of the arguments, and I was there for the first day of the hearing into this matter, and I was quite taken with the opening statement by the British Columbia AG's lawyer, Craig Jones. And he acknowledged that, you know, this law was basically founded and what they say, it was overbroad and clumsy law founded solely on puritanical Christian prejudice that were at least in origin punitive, racist, and imperialist, and a law that remains demeaning to the practitioners of polygamy. That was, of course, you know, the amicus's argument about where this comes from. But Craig Jones then went on to say, yeah, that's true. It was founded back then, but you know what? It makes really good sense, because this is about protecting women and children. Can you sort of elaborate on the arguments that have been made both pro and against what's gone on here? Because there was a lot of participation in this.
Well, there's no doubt. And there's no doubt that in this case, we saw opposing interests come together. And when I say opposing interests, I mean left and right. I mean pro-life and pro-choice. I mean the feminist and the real women. We saw groups that would not normally be on the same side of any issue come together to protect women and children. The arguments were clear and convincing, and I have to say, and I'm not ashamed to say, that I didn't care. I didn't care about this issue 10 years ago. Didn't even know about the issue. It just wasn't on my radar. I didn't know, didn't care. If someone would have said, is there polygamy being practiced in Canada? I would have said, probably not, but if it is, you know, live and let live. I had no idea what was going on. Once I started looking into this, I was shocked. Polygamy, wherever it is practiced, is always about slavery. Mm-hmm. It's always about subjugating individuals, human beings, whether they're adult women or whether they are young children, both boys and girls. It is always abusive in every instance where it has occurred. We brought in an expert, an Orthodox Jewish woman from San Diego State University, and she gave testimony as an economist that leaving aside every religious reason why you might have an opinion one way or the other on the issue, purely from the standpoint of society, this kind of law is bad. She studied under 9 Nobel Prize-winning economists, and for over 30 years, she studied the impact of polygamy on societies. She studied it in every culture, whether it's animist in southern Central Africa, whether it's Jewish or Muslim in the Middle East, whether it's Christian in Canada or the United States, or whether it's part of a Wiccan religion. All of those religions were studied, and in every case, the evidence is clear that those who are practicing it are unfortunately abusing the rights of individuals. And, you know, even men, like I'm a man, so I'm not typically going to be the one that will be abused as a second, third, and fourth wife and traded, you know, with the kind of human trafficking that's there. But I could really identify with the Lost Boys. We had another expert who we brought in who testified about how the Lost Boys were treated. And effectively, how do you preserve a young teenage girl for a 50 or 60-year-old man if there's teenage boys around? Well, you don't. So you've got to kick them out.
Jerry, tell us.
On some pretext, they kick them out of the community. These young boys then are engaged in crime and engaged in drug abuse, and they just don't know how to basically get along in society because they're thrown out of the communities with no mentors and no leaders.
So when you talk about the Lost Boys, and these are the young men that are disposable, they're cast-offs, they're cast about into a world that they're not really prepared or equipped with, no support system. So that's a term that's been used throughout this trial, then, the Lost Boys.
Well, that's right. And we heard evidence, for example, from China, where the one child policy led to a preference for boys. So in some of the provinces, some of the states, there were more boys born than girls, and significantly more, hundreds of thousands more boys. And they found that the crime rates skyrocketed in those communities. And in the very next province where they didn't practice the one child policy, there was not this skyrocketing crime rate.
Jerry,
so there's just no doubt that there's a very negative impact, and the court heard all that evidence.
Jerry, I remember in George Gilder's book, Men and Marriage, he says, the most dangerous animal on the face of the planet Earth is the unmarried human male. That's virtually where, like 90% of violent crime comes out of that cohort, young, unmarried human men.
Now, Jerry, did the issues of the trafficking, you used the term trafficking, in young girls come up through the trial?
Absolutely. In fact, the very last day of the trial, new evidence was presented that these fathers who were in their 50s took young girls as young as 12 down to the United States to be the brides of the leader of the group.
You were almost choking on the term fathers as you were using that word to describe this scene.
So it was quite shocking. It was dramatic. And Craig Jones, the lawyer for the British Columbia government, you could see that he was incensed. He was very, very aggressive with the court in saying, this is about protecting young children. This is about protecting the people in these communities from this abuse. And effective, and the words I use, I did not hold back. I said, this is slavery, nothing less than full-on slavery. Accept slavery today? Of course we would not. Well, this is slavery. This is trafficking in human beings.
Well,
there is clear evidence of that.
This is sexual slavery of young girls.
It is. Mm-hmm. But the evidence was even worse than that. The evidence was that wives were traded and moved about at the whim of the leader for the purposes of punishing political opponents and rewarding political supporters within the community.
Was that in the case of Warren Jeffs or Winston Blackmore?
That was within the community of Bountiful. Obviously, it all also happened south of the border.
Yeah, yeah.
But Warren Jeffs is the leader of one of those communities.
Yeah.
Jerry, I want to talk about another aspect of this, and I know Ron's going to touch on it because there's another part that's going on. I mean, Winston Blackmore is costing us BC taxpayers a lot of money with a lot of court things happening here. But one of the issues that I've tried to raise when I talk to people about this is, you know, aside from the human tragedy, which we don't want to diminish at all, but there's another issue that's economically related that, you know, with the social services that we have here in this country and the fact that, you know, Winston, you know, is said to have 100-plus children, you know, if he were to die, you know, would all those wives be entitled to having their widow's pensions? Would the children have their access to their orphan funds, which would mean $200 per month per kid, you know, under 19, up to 24 if they're still at school or living at home? You know, that's a huge economic implication to us as taxpayers to have to facilitate that because this one guy decided to bring in 100 children into this world.
The evidence that was presented in this case highlighted that impact in some communities. For example, in Israel, there was one example of a one man who went through and he didn't actually marry dozens of women, but treated them all as his wives and. He basically collected welfare, and it was a very profitable operation for him because he had all of his wives in two apartment buildings, and he collected the money, and they were able to live communally and put money into his bank account. We did find evidence that we weren't able to bring to court just because of timing, that in many counties in the state of Utah, those counties with high polygamous communities had significantly higher incidences of welfare and food stamps. And so the economic impact is clearly dramatic, particularly today in our social welfare economies. Maybe 100 years ago when there was no such thing, everybody... Well, you know, every family for itself, if you will.
Yeah.
And so there really wasn't an impact. But today, with the way in which our society is established, there is an expectation that if you have a family, you are responsible, and it's the social welfare net is only there for those who, out of no fault of their own, fall into that.
Hmm.
This appears, is, not the case in these other communities. It's a purposeful creation of a number of women who do not have a husband that is married to them under the laws of Canada.
Well, I remember reading about 6 months ago from Toronto a story about some Muslim men who had the allowed four wives. Allowed under their religion, and all four of the wives, in the cases being reported, were on welfare with their children drawing benefits. I've got a story here about Winston Blackmore, who has had a judgment against him in tax court. He's been ordered to pay $50,000 in costs and $147,000 in penalties. He asserted that he and members of his family and other fundamentalist Mormons in Bountiful who accept him as their spiritual leader ought to be taxed as a congregation and not as individuals, which would have...
So this was tax court?
This was tax court, yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
And, so, if they were taxed as a congregation, then there'd be no tax at all.
Yeah, exactly. And so he's claiming we're a congregation, we're not a family, we're not individuals in a family, and everything we earn goes to the congregation, so no tax. That has... He's been ruled against on that, so I'm glad they've... glad we've caught that one.
Huh.
But it shows how... If they are allowed to slide under one part of the law, they will abuse it under another.
Jerry, what was your sense in because the day I attended was, I mean, it was half like, how was this thing going to work? Of course, there was big discussions going on with, I think it was CBC made their application to televise it. But what was the, towards the end of the hearings, after all this evidence that so profoundly proves that, you know, this is a terrible, tragic situation that's happening for women and children. What was the mood in that courtroom? And did you get any sense or feel from the judge on what arguments were of significance to him? Or was he just paying attention to everything?
Well, I think that the mood was very respectful. The audience was diverse, some pro and some con. But I did not sense a sense of cheering one way or the other or triumphalism one way or the other. And amongst the counsel, I think they were very professional. I think the judge was very professional. He certainly did not in any way give us a hint as to which way he was going to go. So I can't predict which way he's going to go based upon what he did. I can predict based upon the evidence and the legal argument that was presented. I think he will rule in favor of the law, and I think he will uphold the law because the arguments, in my view, were persuasive, and the evidence was overwhelming that there was harm. Our argument, though, was that the whole issue of what goes into the criminal code and what doesn't is for the Parliament of Canada. And we asked the judge to exercise restraint and refuse to hold the criminal code up to a judgment that he might make if he was a legislator. We urged him to make the judgment as a judge and simply respect the decision of Parliament if the legislation was rational, related to the objective of the criminal code, and the word that lawyers use, not colorable. In other words, it's not used for some ulterior motive. For example, it could be that if this legislation was intended to discriminate against a particular religious group for the purpose of keeping that religious group out of the country or suppressing them, harming them, then this kind of criminal code provision would be illegitimate. But we argued, and so did the Attorney General, that there was no evidence that there was any ulterior motive here, that the only motive was to protect women, protect children, protect individuals from abuse. And we think that the experts that the Attorney General and both Attorneys General and our client brought to the court clearly supported that conclusion. Ironically, the other side, the lawyers for the amicus curiae arguing against the law, made a very interesting argument. And I laugh because you can only see any rationality in their argument if you hadn't heard all of the evidence about the abuse that's carried on in these communities. But the argument was that, well, you know, if you're going to argue that the fact that there's lost boys out there makes this law constitutional, what you're really doing is you're saying that any woman who doesn't marry a man is responsible for an increased crime rate in our society. So that means every widow, every spinster, every lesbian, every divorcee, every one of them is responsible for an increased crime rate. And really, that's the essence of your argument. And of course, again, you could. It's only funny because it's just so outrageous when you compare it against the evidence that was so clear about the real issue. And this isn't about a game of constitutional chess. It is truly about protecting real children and real women from a life of abuse in these communities. Abuse that was and is certainly up to and including murder.
Jerry, the Attorney General's submission on this said that what they're asking for would make Canada the only Western nation to decriminalize polygamy. I recall there was a case in France, and I think it was in 1993, when France briefly decriminalized polygamy on behalf of some of the Muslim families that were coming in from Algeria. But they later turned that around because do you recall anything about that case? Was that cited in court?
Absolutely, it was. Our witness, our economist, gave testimony specifically about what happened in France. She's bilingual and studied that situation very closely. Some women's groups in Quebec, funded by the government of Quebec, did an extensive report on what happened in France. And what France found was that when they decided not to enforce their law against polygamy, and it wasn't a matter of repealing it, they just, as a matter of executive fiat, much like British Columbia, just decided to not enforce the law. They found that it became unmanageable within their society. The crime and the harm that was within that, within those communities became outrageous.
Jerry, I want to ask you about the witnesses that appeared. We've talked a lot about the expert testimony, but were there women who had left Bountiful? Did they give their evidence? Did they talk about the what kind of life that they were destined to within this polygamous cult?
Absolutely, and we had many who had left those communities. They gave their evidence by way of video, as well as some of them came in person where the amicus wanted to cross-examine them. But there were those who were currently living in the community who came to testify. Interestingly enough, only the women came to testify. The men who had originally planned to testify pulled out at the last minute and did not give evidence. It's interesting that the women admitted that while there were religious reasons for doing what they were doing, it wasn't a religious mandate. In other words, individuals who chose not to, or because of their circumstances, were not involved in a polygamous marriage, were not on that basis alone kicked out of the community. And our position was clear, that this is not about religion, that the criminal code on its face does not discriminate on the basis of religion, and therefore we urge the Chief Justice to uphold the law because there is no valid claim of religious discrimination here. And remember, we are the Christian Legal Fellowship. We're very interested in protecting freedom of religion. That's essential for us. So we were there to absolutely defend freedom of religion at all times. But we were clearly arguing before the court that there was no violation of freedom of religion, and that if there was an argument to be made in a particular case, the court should only address those kinds of issues when they're raised by individuals who claim to have their religious freedom infringed.
Jerry, you not only are well-versed and insightful to the issues involving the polygamy case, and we anticipate when the decision will come down in a couple, 3 months, somewhere in there?
I would say we will get the decision sometime around Thanksgiving.
Okay.
That would be my guess.
Well, and I hope at that time when the decision comes down that you'll come back and give us your thoughts on how the judge rules in that case. But in the meantime, you are still extraordinarily busy. You've got two other very high-profile cases that you're involved in. You're involved with the Marriage Commission issues in Saskatchewan and also Stephen Boyson, another very important free speech issue. These free speech issues, man, they are taking up the court's time these days. I thought Stephen Boyson was victorious and they had run out of their appeal time, but you tell me that case has been resurrected?
Yes, the case was set aside, and in other words, the appeal was dismissed, but the lawyer for the professor at the University of Calgary, Dr. Lund, went and made an application to resurrect the case. And because the court typically gives you a freebie in this kind of case, they allowed the appeal to be reinstated. And now the hearing will take place. The Court of Appeal will hear the case in December of this year.
And that's in Alberta.
And as your listeners may know, the Court of Queen's Bench of Alberta, a judge who used to be a Crown prosecutor, came down with a very stinging indictment of the Human Rights Commission in Alberta.
Yeah.
Completely reversed the decision on every ground, and said that they had no jurisdiction to require an apology. They had no jurisdiction to enforce an injunction stopping my client from ever talking about the subject again. They had no jurisdiction to award damages against him or costs. And it was quite a thorough spanking that the Human Rights Commission got. In fact, the judge went so far as to say that there was evidence of some kind of almost bias. In other
yes.
words, it appeared that there was bias. So the court said this is wrong and set it aside. The appeal has been launched, and we'll see what happens.
Okay, now what's happening in Saskatchewan then with the Marriage Commissioner case? Give us a little bit of background on that.
This is an important one, and here's why. If the Saskatchewan case is not overturned, if we do not see a change, the precedent set by the Saskatchewan Court of Appeal will effectively mean that anyone in public service in Canada cannot ever exercise their own conscience. They must at all times, when they find that their conscience conflicts with a direction from a particular ministry, that they must resign. Now the impact of that is even on judges. Judges are civil servants, and so judges will no longer be able to recuse themselves. Instead, if they happen to disagree with a particular let's say an applicant before them, they can't just simply say, well, I'm recusing myself from this case because of a potential conflict. They must simply resign if it's about some kind of moral issue.
Wow.
Fortunately, the marriage commissioners in Saskatchewan are made of some pretty strong stuff. They are refusing to accept the decision of the Saskatchewan Attorney General to not accommodate marriage commissioners, and they are taking their case back to court and asking the court to declare that the government must accommodate them.
Okay, so what?
And
court,
you may
what?
Say, well, how can we win on that? Because the Court of Appeal rejected the reference question from the court, from the Saskatchewan government. So how can we win this? Well, we can, and it's an interesting analysis, but it's pretty clear. The Saskatchewan Court of Appeal identified in their judgment that while they disagreed with the Saskatchewan government proposal to accommodate, They said there is an accommodation out there that we would support, and it's the Ontario model. And the difference between the Saskatchewan model and the Ontario model was Saskatchewan just allows the individual to talk directly to the marriage commissioner, and the marriage commissioner, you know, in a very frank and open way, says, I can or I can't, I will or I won't. In Ontario, there's a bureaucracy inserted between the marriage commissioner and the couple, and in Ontario, the ministry, that inserted bureaucracy, simply finds a marriage commissioner that's willing to take a case, and so the couple never know whether someone has rejected their case on the basis of religious convictions.
So wait a minute. So you're telling me a scheduling secretary could solve this whole problem?
That's what the Court of Appeal of Saskatchewan said. And the government of Saskatchewan said, no, we're not going to pay for that. We're not going to spend money on that. We don't have to, and we won't. And so that was the answer. That was the end of the discussion. Well, they thought. The marriage commissioner said, no, we're back in the saddle again on this. We're taking it to the Saskatchewan Court of Queen's Bench, and they're asking the court to order the government of Saskatchewan to accommodate them. And, of course, if the government is required by that court order to accommodate them, then, of course, there is the Ontario model that's available to them. And it seems to make sense that if you can come up with a model that is respectful of both sides in an argument, both sides in a religious dispute or a political dispute, why wouldn't you?
Yeah.
And so we're quite optimistic that the Saskatchewan courts will say, yes, the Saskatchewan government failed to come up with an accommodation that works, but that doesn't relieve them of the duty to accommodate these individuals, particularly when there's a Supreme Court of Canada judgment in the same-sex marriage case that says that you must accommodate religious officials.
But Jerry, this is what's interesting, though. If the Saskatchewan Court of Appeal decision is allowed to stand, because you're not talking about appealing that up to the Supreme Court of Canada, you're going around and you're looking for a declaration from the court that this is a more sensible, common, better way of doing things. But that mm-hmm. Court of Appeal decision, doesn't that still stay? Doesn't that still have some validity unless it's challenged?
I think that you're right. I'm very uncomfortable with the reasoning of the five judges. The five judges did not apply the Supreme Court of Canada's authority properly. But at least no one, when they look back on the actual issue in this case, marriage commissioners, will find a reason or an excuse to not accommodate. Saskatchewan will show that when you look at the decisions that will follow, there will be an accommodation available. And so we hope that the decision will then be forgotten as a very unique decision based exclusively on its facts, and that the general duty to accommodate is not in any way limited. It's just Saskatchewan made a mistake in that case and simply didn't come up with the right model.
Jerry Chipier, we are fast running out of time here, but of course my take care of everybody fighting the good fight antennas are up. Stephen Boyson, Christian Legal Fellowship, donations, and we've got 2 minutes here, so can you quickly give us where to direct them, how to get them there, and what do you need?
Well, if you just go to www.millerthompson.com and click on my name, you'll get our address. We have a trust account, and if individuals need a religious a charitable receipt, we have organizations both in the U.S. and Canada who are able to give receipts for donations to help either organization. And I know both organizations are going to be fighting the good fight for many years to come, both in on the cases that we currently have, but there is no doubt there will be more.
Jerry, MillerThompson.com, is that Thompson with a P or without?
Without.
Okay.
No P in Thompson, and
no
we'll certainly be happy to help.
And I think if people just go onto our homepage at roadkillradio.com and click on your name, it'll take them right there. We make it really easy for everybody. Jerry Chipier.
Perfect.
Jerry, thank you so much for your time tonight, and I look forward to the next time we chat. Always a wealth of information and insight and important information for Canadians to know what's going on in our courts. And I thank you for all your good work.
You're welcome.
Jerry, do get back in touch with us when this polygamy decision comes down, because we'd love to have you walk us through it and help us sort it out.
We'll definitely do so.
All right, okay. That'll be a date. Jerry Tippier, thank you so
good
much.
Good night, Jerry.
Well, what a fast night, Ron Gray.
Yeah, and those all manner of things that we didn't get up to that we wanted to talk about, like Saudi Arabia taking over Delta Airlines.
Oh, yeah, right up there on the top of Kerry's list. Next week, Mark Hasek is going to be sitting in your seat joining me. We've got Steve Anderson from openmedia.ca coming to talk with us. He's in Ottawa as we speak, attending the CRTC hearings involving internet freedom and regulation, Ron Gray.
Yeah.
Important stuff, people, because this is your freedom to communicate. The big wigs are talking about making the decisions. Nobody asked Kerry. Did anyone ask Ron?
No, nobody. Don't let the bureaucrats run your internet.
All right. My computer's burned out, so what time are we at? I bet we're out of time.
We are at 9:30. It's time to say goodnight. Goodnight, everybody.
Goodnight, everybody.
You've been listening to Roadkill Radio. Join us again next week for another trip down the superhighway of information, fact, and truth.